Blog Talk Radio.
To the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands,
one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. With liberty and justice for who? Not for the majority of people in this country. Definitely not for anyone who isn't a white American. Absolutely not for anyone who opposes or even questions the domestic or foreign policies of this country. Few, if any, nations have ever had as many of its leaders assassinated as the U.S. has. Few, if any, nations have inflicted as much military and economic power throughout the world as the U.S. has. Few, if any, nation, other nation, have killed or has killed through war, genocide, and economic sanctions more people than the U.S. has. Few, if any, other countries have over 3 million of its citizens incarcerated. Few, if any, nations have as high a violent crime rate as the U.S. has. No nation in history has ever spent half of its national budget on military spending. No nation's leaders, except the U.S., have ever stated that we are the policeman of the world. And no nation other than Nazi Germany and the U.S. has ever preemptively attacked another nation without provocation and established a national doctrine to do so. If the U.S. government authorizes this aggressive warmongering foreign policy without majority opposition from its people, how can anyone deny that the U.S. is the most violent and militaristic nation in the world? And how can any rational-thinking human being deny the arrogant and imperialistic character of the American people? I am constantly amazed at the ability of the American people to consciously deny every aspect of their own violent behaviors when the evidence is so clearly apparent that Americans are the most violent people in the world. Our military speaks of the death of innocent victims from their military operations as collateral damage. We continue to use depleted uranium ammunition to fight our imperialistic wars around the world, contaminating entire civilizations with radioactive pollution that kills and deforms all present and future generations of children and adults in these embattled countries, exposing our own military men and women to radiation-caused diseases, and denying them the truth about their exposure, and denying them proper medical and disability benefits upon their return home. Any sane individual must ask why these munitions are manufactured, though they are supposedly banned by international treaties, and why are they being used by a nation who so arrogantly pronounces its desire for freedom, liberty, and democracy, and so hypocritically criticizes other nations for human rights violations? The U.S. has once again attacked a foreign nation in the guise of bringing democracy to the Middle East. The U.S. led invasion of Libya is again a preemptive strike against a non-threatening nation. This is wrong. This is unjust. This is an abuse of military power against a sovereign nation. This is an unauthorized declaration of war on a weak nation, led by the most powerful nation in the world. Gaddafi poses no threat to the world or to the U.S. Gaddafi is and has been the leader of Libya for 40 years. Even after his notorious known sponsoring of terrorism for the last 30 years, no one has attempted to remove him from power. And as we attack Libya, our ally Israel has been funding and soliciting over 50,000 mercenaries to support Gaddafi. The Israeli military and the government is entirely supported by the U.S. Why would we want to support Gaddafi by supplying him with mercenaries to fight his own people and then attack him? This is the insanity of our leaders and our foreign policy. We fight and supply both sides of every conflict to keep our military-industrial complex alive and well. The U.S. economy is completely dependent upon the manufacturing and sales of larger and more deadly weapons. Trillions of U.S. taxpayer dollars are spent for endless wars and conflicts throughout the world, without any objections by our Congress or the complicit national media. They understand that U.S.-sponsored death, and destruction around the world is the backbone of the U.S. economy and the avenue best used to vent outwards the inherent violence of the American people, to prevent Americans from venting their violence inward and destroying their own government and themselves. On Sunday, March 20th, 2011, I stood on the green in Litchfield, Connecticut, with 30 other American citizens protesting the attack against Libya and all the wars the U.S. has entered into and still is involved in during the last decade. We were all aware that we were under close surveillance by the state police and other agencies as we peacefully gathered and held signs denouncing the wrongful American military involvement. We proudly stood for peace and for our constitutional rights of freedom of speech and peaceful assembly. And while being closely watched and photographed by armed policemen sitting in their vehicles. But we continued our protest for several hours, remaining resistant and indifferent to the obvious police intimidation. And on 3-20-03-2003, the U.S. attacked Iraq under the euphemistic name of Operation Enduring Freedom. On the same date, 8 years later, the U.S. launched another preemptive attack against Libya, euphemistically named Odyssey Dawn, with little outrage by the American people. 100 courageous Americans were arrested when they refused to leave the gates of the White House during their protest on March 19, 2011. And none of this was mentioned by the network news sources. Nothing has been reported about these arrests since the mainstream media. I am resolved to stand until I can no longer stand. Then I will sit, or lay, or crawl to continue protesting the U.S. involvement in these unjust wars. Those who do not are admitting their indifference. Those who do not are admitting their own guilt and ignorance. Those who do not protest their government's involvement in the worldwide massacre of their fellow human beings are guilty of war crimes and crimes against humanity. Americans will be judged by the world for their crimes against humanity. When they are, either their powerful military or their own personal arsenal will be able to protect them from world justice.
Love Hope Radio.
My next article is a prayer for the Japanese.
Long Hope Radio.
Sorry. All right. Prayer for the Japanese. Gomen Nasai, which in Japanese means I'm sorry. A proud people are now in peril. The hell of nuclear disaster again threatens their nation. Remedy can only be hoped for. The nightmare to come can only be imagined. Living within 100 miles of two active nuclear power plants and knowing full well their volatility, I must live in denial, believing they are safe. The demonic vision of nuclear energy is too horrible to comprehend. No insurance company in the world will insure a nuclear plant. No nation is prepared to save its people or prevent the massive loss of lives if another Chernobyl or Fukushima event occurs. The greatest lie told by world governments and the nuclear industry is nuclear power is safe. I laughed this morning at the ignorance of Bob Herbert, the New York Times columnist who appeared on MSNBC Morning Joe. He stated that the United States government would never lie to its people about a national disaster. What a fool. What a spin doctor. That is why he writes for the New York Times. I can name at least 10 major national disasters that have occurred within the last 10 years in the United States, where the government and the media were totally complicit in lying to the American people. 9-1-1, the air in New York is safe to breathe. The Iraq War, the Afghanistan War, the Gulf oil spill, Katrina, 2000 and 2004 presidential elections, support for Israel's brutal occupation of Palestine, the denial of chemtrails and geoengineering the weather. The list of lies goes on, and the $12.5 trillion unreported by the Federal Reserve giving to bail out foreign banks, the arrangement between Obama and BP on April 20, 2009, to exempt BP from British Petroleum from new offshore drilling regulations, the arrangement of Obama and all pharmaceutical companies not to allow price bargaining by Medicare or Obamacare, the censorship of the Bush 1 and 2 administrations on all information leading to the Gulf 1 and Gulf 2 wars, the lies and deceit of Bill Clinton and his destruction of the American middle class by instituting NAFTA, and the list of lies is endless, yet we allow idiot pundits like Bob Herbert and Joe Scarborough and other known national morons to insult the intelligence of all well-informed Americans. This is a prayer for the Japanese, who have suffered more than any other nation for the lies and deceit of its own government and the lies of the nuclear industry. May they survive this recent disaster and live again as a people and an economy. May the demonic hordes of nuclear salesmen, representing their demonic corporations, fall in the abyss of their greed and deception. May the world never again see the building of a nuclear power plant. May all existing nuclear power plants be dismantled and nuclear power forever banned from the earth. So, anyway, from that, I'm going to jump right over to a remarkable essayist, Ralph Waldo Emerson. And, but before I do, I just want to mention again that I'm getting extremely tired, extremely frustrated, and extremely overwhelmed at how we as a nation can allow our government to continually enter us into these mindless wars and invest our treasure and our soldiers and our, you know, in these incredibly insane wars, with no end. I read today that the Libyan war may be another very long war, just like Iraq and Afghanistan were. Because Gaddafi has a lot of support. The last thing anybody wants is the United States to take over, the United States and Europe to take over a sovereign country again in Africa. So, here we are on the verge of another major military involvement. Unapproved by Congress, unauthorized by Congress, and authorized by none other than the Nobel Peace Prize laureate, Mr. Obama himself. I mean, how can we accept this? How can anybody in their right mind, with an ounce of ethics, with an ounce of justice, in their, you know, sense of justice, allow condemning it publicly. How? You can't. You can't. Unless you are indifferent to it and allowing yourself to be swept up in it to where it doesn't matter. Oh, what difference does it matter? What difference? Who cares if there's another 100,000 dead Africans? Who cares? Or Libyans? Who cares? As long as we get the oil. We don't get the oil. We just pay the bill. All the oil, that's why there's such a coalition of NATO there in Libya, is because all the oil is going to Europe. Right? It always has. Libyan oil constantly going into Europe. So, made deals that way. But probably nobody's more surprised at the reaction of Europe than Gaddafi himself. Must be amazed, at the greed and the animals, that he's dealing with. They call him an animal. Nobody's a bigger animal than Obama himself, our president, warmongering, military, just amazing. But anyway, that's why I wrote this essay, and I wish that everybody would wake up and protest as well. Not the way the world works, unfortunately. And most people will just ignore it. The essay, I'm probably not going to have a chance to complete this tonight. And I've done this before. I've read this before several years ago. And it's probably in the archives, I'm sure. But I was reading this again tonight, and to me, if I can get through the next four or five pages of this essay, I think it's quite inspiring. It's by Ralph Waldo Emerson. It's called Circles. Nature centers into balls, and her proud ephemerals, fast to surface and outside, scan the profile of the sphere. Knew they what that signified. A new genesis were here. The eye is the first circle. The horizon which it forms is the second. And throughout nature, this primary figure is repeated without end. It is the highest emblem in the cipher of the world. St. Augustine described the nature of God as a circle whose center was everywhere and its circumference nowhere. We are all our lifetime reading the copious sense of the first of forms. One moral we have already deduced in considering the circular or compensatory character of every human action. Another analogy we shall now trace, that every action admits of being outdone. Our life is an apprenticeship to the truth, that around every circle another can be drawn, and there is no end in nature, but every end is a beginning, that there is always another dawn arisen on mid noon, and under every deep a lower deep opens. This fact, as far as it symbolizes the moral character, the moral fact of the unattainable, flying perfect, around which the hands of man can never meet, at once the inspirer and the condemner of every success, may conveniently serve us to connect many illustrations of human power in every department. There are no fixtures in nature. The universe is fluid and volatile. Permanence is but a word of degrees. Our globe, seen by God, is a transparent law, not a mass of facts. The law dissolves the fact and holds it fluid. Our culture is the prominence of an idea, which draws after it this train of cities and institutions. Let us rise into another idea. They will disappear. The Greek sculpture is all melted away as if it had been statues of ice, and here and there a solitary figure or fragment remaining, as we see flecks and scraps of snow left in cold dells and mountain clefts in June and July. But the genius that created it creates now somewhat else. The Greek letters last a little longer, but are already passing under the same sentence and tumbling into the inevitable pit which the creation of new thought opens for all that is old. And the new continents are built out of the ruins of the old planet, and the new races fed out of the decomposition of the foregoing. And new arts destroy the old. See the investment of the capital in aqueducts, and made useless by hydraulics, fortifications by gunpowder, roads and canals, by railways, sails, by steam by electricity. You admire the tower of granite weathering the hurts of so many ages. Yet a little waving hand built this huge wall, and that which builds is better than that which is built. And the hand that built can topple it down much faster, better than the hand, and nimbler was the invisible thought which wrought through it. And thus, ever behind the course effect is a fine cause, which being narrowly seen, is itself the effect of a finer cause. Everything looks permanent until its seen secret is known. A rich estate appears to women a firm and lasting fact, to a merchant one easily created out of any materials and easily lost. An orchard, good tillage, good grounds seem a fixture like a gold mine or a river to a citizen, but to a large farmer not much more fixed than the state of the crop. Nature looks provokingly stable and secular, but it has a cause like all the rest. And when once I comprehend what will these fields stretch so immovably wide, these leaves hang so individually considerable. Permanence is a word of degrees. Everything is medial. Moons are no more bound to spiritual powers than bat balls. The key to every man is his thought. Study and defying though he look, or rather sturdy and defying though he look, he has a helm which he obeys, which is the idea after which all his facts are classified. He can only be reformed by showing him a new idea, which commands his own. The life of a man is a self-evolving circle, which from a ring imperceptibly small rushes on all sides outwards to new and larger circles, and that without end. And the extent to which this generation of circles wheel without wheel will go depends on the force or truth of the individual soul. For it is the inert effort of each thought, having formed itself into a circular wave of circumstance, as for instance an empire, rules of an art, a local usage, a religious rite, to heap itself on that ridge and to solidify and hem in the life. But if the soul is quick and strong, it bursts over the boundary on all sides and expands another orbit on the great deep, but also runs up into a high wave, with attempt again to stop and to bind. But the heart refuses to be imprisoned. In its first and narrowest pulses, it already tends outward, and with a vast force, and to eminence, and innumerable expansions. Every ultimate fact is only the first of a new series. Every general law, only a particular fact of some more general law presently to disclose itself. There is no outside, no inner enclosing wall, no circumference to us. The man finishes his story, how good, how final, how it puts a new face on all things. He fills the sky. Lo, on the other side, rises also a man and draws a circle around the circle we had just pronounced the outline of the sphere. Then suddenly, in our first speaker, not man, but only a first speaker, his only redress is forthwith to draw a circle outside of his antagonist. And so men do by themselves. The result of today, which haunts the minds and cannot be escaped, will presently be abridged by a word, and the principle that seemed to explain nature will itself be included as one example of a bolder generalization. In the thought of tomorrow, there is a power to upheave all thy creed, all the creeds, all the literatures of the nations, and marshal thee to a heaven which no epic dream has yet depicted. Every man is not so much a workman in the world as he is a suggestion of that he should be. Men walk as prophecies of the next age. Step by step, we scale this mysterious ladder. The steps are actions. The new prospect is power. Every several results is threatened and judged by that which follows. And every one seems to be contradicted by the new. It is only limited by the new. The new statement is also heeded by the old, and to those dwelling in the old comes like an abyss of skepticism. But the eye soon gets wonted to it, and the eye and it are effects of one cause. Then its innocency and benefit appear. And presently, all its energy spent, it pales and dwindles before the revelation of the new hour. And fear not the new generalization. Does the fact look crass and material, threatening to degrade thy theory of spirit? Resist it not. It goes to refine and raise thy faith, and raise thy theory of matter just as much. There are no fixtures to men. If we appeal to consciousness, every man supposes himself not to be fully understood. And if there is any truth in him, if he rests at last on the divine soul, I see not how it can be otherwise. The last chamber, the last closet, he must feel was never open, and there is always a residuum unknown, unanalyzable. That is, every man believes that he has a greater possibility. Our moods do not believe in each other. Today I am full of thoughts and can write what I please. I see no reason why I should not have the same thought, the same power of expression tomorrow. What I write wills I write it, and seemed the most natural thing in the world, but yesterday I saw a dreary vacuity in this direction, in which now I see so much, and a month hence I doubt not I shall wonder who he was that wrote so many continuous pages. And alas, for this infirm faith, this will not strenuous, this vast ebb of a vast flow. I am God in nature. I am a weed by the wall. The continual effort to raise himself above himself, to work a pitch above his last height, betrays itself in a man's relations. We thirst for approbation. We cannot forgive the approver. The sweet of nature is love, yet I have a friend. I am tormented by my imperfections. If I have a friend, I am tormented by my imperfections. The love of me accuses the other party. If he were high enough to slight me, then could I love him and rise by my affection to new heights? A man's growth is seen in the successive choirs of his friends. And for every friend whom he loses for truth, he gains a better. I thought as I walked in the woods and mused on my friends, why should I play with them this game of idolatry? I know and see too well, but not voluntarily blind, the speedy limits of persons called high and worthy. Rich, noble, and great they are by the liberality of our speech, but truth is sad. O blessed spirit, whom I forsake for these, they are not thou. And every personal consideration that we allow costs us heavenly state, and we sell the thrones of angels for a short and turbulent pleasure. And how often must we learn this lesson? Men cease to interest us when we find their limitations. And the only sin is limitation. As soon as you once come up with a man's limitations, it is all over with him. And he has he talents? Has he enterprise? Has he knowledge? It boots not. Infinitely alluring and attractive was he to you yesterday, a great hope, a sea to swim in. Now you have found his shores and found it a pond, and you care not if you never see it again. And that happens quite often when you meet somebody who's closed-minded and bigoted and racist and, has no non-open. And there's millions of people like that, believe me. They're all over the place. Neighbors, friends, family members. They're everywhere. And, very, very difficult to deal with. But you have to, but you have to deal with it. But it doesn't mean that, once you see their limitations, that's it. You realize that these people won't go any further. They're just substandard, in their intellect, and you don't really want to mess with them anymore. You don't. There's nothing interesting they have to say. So, and it's the same way with so many authors and so many writers I've read and interviewed. It's like there's just a level of intellect that, that's it. And it's no more, Or they just put out some garbage, and fortunately some publisher, picked it up and says, oh, this is good garbage. This should sell. And unfortunately that happens. And then good books, great books, get trashed, and not even published. Because the truth isn't allowed to get out. Emerson wrote this stuff nearly 200 years ago, and 150, 60 years ago. And it's out there, but and revered by many, but still not listened to by very many people. But that's how it works. And let me get back to this. Each new step we take in the thought reconciles 20 seemingly discordant facts as expressions of one law. Aristotle and Plato are reckoned the respective heads of two schools. A wise man will see that Aristotle platonizes by going one step farther back in thought. Discordant opinions are reconciled by being seen to be two extremes of one principle. and we can never go back, and we can never go so far back as to preclude a still higher vision. Beware when the great gods let loose a thinker on this planet. Then all things are at risk. It is as when a conflagration is broken out in a great city, and no man knows where what is safe or where it will end. There is not a piece of science, but its flank may be turned tomorrow. And there is not any literary reputation, not the so-called eternal names of fame, that may not be revised and condemned. The very hopes of man, the thoughts of his heart, the religion of nations, the manners and morals of mankind are all at the mercy of a new generalization. Generalization is always a new influx of the divinity into the mind, and hence the thrill that attends it. Valor consists in the power of self-recovery, so that a man cannot have his flank turned, cannot be out-generalized, or out-generaled, rather, but put him where you will, and he stands. This can only be by his preferring truth to his past apprehension of truth, and his alert acceptance of it from wherever quarter. The intrepid conviction that his laws, his relations to society, his Christianity, his world, may at any time be superseded and decreased, and deceased, rather. And that's so true. I mean, an open-minded person is one who understands that at any time, what he has been led to believe could be different, could be changed, but yet, you know, could change. More information comes together. You see something, you experience something, you know, that brings it all together for you. And it's like the great cosmic law that all truth is half truth. And as above, so below. We are so quick to insist that what we know, what we're led to believe is true, right? But at the same time, we were so reluctant to give up those beliefs, okay, when something else is presented in as fact or reality, and we refuse to accept it. It's like a person refuses to accept that he's broke. Continues to spend. Okay, a person refuses to believe that he's sick, and continues to do what made him sick until he dies. You know, and on his own, stupidity. This happens all the time, where our general beliefs are imposed upon us by institutions. By the churches, by the government, by our schools, these things—they were brainwashed from day one. You know, our parents and grandparents and so on to believe certain things. Okay, that they believe. So these beliefs continue, whether they're real or not real. I mean, whether they're true or not true. Doesn't matter. They're still pushed forward, and people are fed to believe it without thinking, without stopping to think what they're accepting. And because of that, that's why everybody gets in so much trouble. Because their ideals or their beliefs systems are all screwed up and all wrong, so that they wake up one day and go, "Holy cripe! What?" What was I believing? Everything's falling apart here. I built a house of cards. It's very, very difficult. But if you keep an open mind to all of these things, then you find that, nothing is in concrete. You know, they're even finding the laws of physics don't apply because of quantum physics, stuff that they just learned. the illusion, the illusions that we live under, the false lives, the lives that we live, deluding ourselves and those around us, creating a nation, if you will, of debt. Okay, based on debt and more debt until we gobble up and eat up the entire world, right, to pay off our debt. And I mean, what do we do? I mean, Americans are not, you know, I mean, this is why I say we're a violent nation, and we are a violent nation, because we will not give up these things without a fight, you know, and we will accumulate these things with fight, with, you know, if that's what we have to do, because we know this. I mean, I personally, you know, no. I mean, I understand. I'm not going to have somebody take things from me, but I, at the same time, I don't feel the need to take things from anybody. And, you know, that's the way I think normal people should react, but Americans have then created this entitlement that they are greater and grander than any other people, so therefore there's a kind of a superiority complex that we've developed that allows us to intercede with every nation, take over nations, and their mind nations, steal their resources, this kind of thing, all under the disguise of democracy and capitalism and the wonders of the world of the Western world, you know, man, or Christianity or whatever. So it's like we are constantly deluding ourselves and not realizing that there's greater and greater and greater and greater concepts out there. And we can't lock ourselves into, like, republicanism and say, you know, the best policy is the ones we had 100 years ago, you know, or 200 years ago, or whatever. You know, you got to look ahead. You know, you got to look ahead and say, what's going on here? How can we best grab the future and make sense out of it and make it work for us? So, I'm going to continue here. I've got about 10 minutes left. There are degrees in idealism. We learn first to play with it academically, as the magnet was once a toy. Then we see in the heyday of youth and poetry that it may be true, and it is true in gleams and fragments. Then its countenance waxes stern and grand, and we see that it must be true, and it now shows itself ethical and practical. And we learn that God is, that He is in me, and that all things are shadows of Him. And the idealism of Berkeley is only a crude statement of the idealism of Jesus, and that again is a crude statement of the fact that all nature is the rapid efflux of goodness, executing and organizing itself. And much more obviously is history and the state of the world as at any one time directly dependent on the intellectual classification then existing in the minds of men. And the things which are dear to men at this hour are so on account of the ideas that have emerged on their mental horizon, and which cause the present order of things as a tree bears its apples. A new degree of culture would instantly revolutionize the entire system of human pursuits. Conversation is a game of circles. In conversation, we pluck termini, which bound the common of silence on every side. And the parties are not to be judged by the Spirit they partake and even express under this Pentecost. Tomorrow they will have receded from this high watermark. Tomorrow you shall find them stooping under the old pack saddles. And yet let us enjoy the cloven flame whilst it glows on our walls. When each new speaker strikes a new light, emancipates us from the oppression of the last speaker, who to oppress us with the greatness and elusiveness of his own thought, then yields us to another Redeemer. We seem to recover our rights to become men. Oh, what truths profound and executable only in ages and orbs are supposed in the announcement of every truth. In common hours, society sits cold and statuesque. We all stand still. We all stand where the waiting empty, knowing possibly that we can be full, surrounded by mighty symbols, which are not symbols to us, but prose and trivial poise. Then cometh the God and converts the statues into fiery men, and by a flash of his eye burns up the veil which shrouded all things and the meaning of the very furniture of cup and saucer, of chair and cloak and tester is manifest, and the facts that loom so large in the fogs of yesterday, property, climate, breeding, personal beauty, and the like, have strangely changed their proportions. All that we reckoned settled shakes and rattles and literatures, cities, climates, religions leave their foundation and dance before our eyes. And yet here again see the swift circumscription. Good as is discourse, silence is better and shames it. And the length of the discourse indicates the distance of thought betwixt the speaker and the hearer. And if there were at a perfect understanding in any part, no words would be necessary thereon. If at one in all parts, no words would be suffered. And to go from that, it's just what I'm saying tonight will be picked up by a listener and bettered, okay, and taken to a higher level, explained to somebody else, and to a higher level, and to a higher level, and to a higher level, and to a different level, to a different interpretation. But nevertheless, be it good, bad, or not, these are the circles, okay, that one creates. A teacher creates provokes that thought in their mind, in someone's mind, and from there, that thought. I was going to say festers, but it doesn't. It percolates, you know, and becomes, you know, it. Depending on the thought, depending on the type of thought, depending on the way the thought is presented, it can ferment and become a fine wine spirit, or it can ferment and rot and become a bad influence on someone. So it's important to keep our thoughts as high minded as they can be, because they have the same effect in the sense that they're reacted upon. And you might as well have thoughts that are positive and react upon in a positive way and expand the human spirit, rather than throw out negative responses, negative thoughts, negative, and that's the most easy to do. Criticism and so on, but they're important. You know, they're important to do that, but they must be taken with a grain of salt as well to understand that whatever it is you're condemning for the good rather than for the sake of simply condemning. you're condemning that, which is a good thing to do. It's a good thing to condemn what is wrong, but it's also a good thing to condone what is right, to build up what is right. And that's why I take time to read these old essays, because there is so much truth in them, and there's so much right in them, and they've time and time and time again, I can read them over and over and over again to myself and come up with something new or inspiring that I knew or that I, you know, needed to hear again, you know. This is what great works do. This is what great men like Emerson have done for our society and for our civilization. They've dared to think. They've dared to be thinkers and question the system, question what they see, question what they see around them and what they hear and those people around them and defy, if they will, their conventional ways of thinking to the extent where it pushes us, it pushes mankind into another orbit, you know, another way to look at things, another perspective, and you know, it's just a brilliant man. Yeah, I got about 3 minutes. I think I'll just finish this paragraph. Literature is a point outside of our hodiernal circle through which a new one may be described. The use of literature is to afford us a platform whence we may command a view of our present life, a purchase by which we may move it. We will ourselves, with ancient learning, install ourselves the best we can in Greek, in Punic, in Roman houses, only that we may wiselier see French, English, and American houses and modes of living. In like manner, we see literature best for the midst of wild nature, or from the din of affairs, or from a high religion. And the field cannot be well seen without from within the field. The astronomer must have his diameter of the earth orbit as a base to find the parallax of any star. Therefore we value the poet. All the argument and all the wisdom is not in an encyclopedia or the treatise on metaphysics or the body of divinity, but in the sonnet of the play. In my daily work I incline to repeat my old steps and do not believe in remedial force, in the power of change and reform. But some Petrarch or Aristo, filled with the new wine of his imagination, writes me an ode of the brisk romance, full of daring thought and action. He smites and arouses me with his shrill tones, breaks up my whole chain of habit, and I open my eye on my own possibilities. He claps wings to the sides of all the solid old lumber of the world, and I am capable once more of choosing a straight path in theory and practice. And with that, I'm going to end tonight's show. I hope you enjoyed it. I want to thank you for bearing with it. And it says, besides your bravest sentiment and familiar to the humblest men, there's so many wonderful quotes that I wanted to get into, and maybe I'll continue this lecture or this essay next week. But in the meantime, I want to thank you for joining me, and I wish you the very, very best, and tell your friends about us, and join us right here next week again at Tuesday night from 8 to 10, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, and I wish you well, and oh, by the way, you can go to rwe.org and get all of the works by Ralph Waldo Emerson. Again, that's rwe.org, and all his works are right there. And good night.